Well, this afternoon, we have a tag team approach to our subject of Mud Springs and Rush Creek, and you can see the title up on the screen. Dr. Peter Bleed is professor of anthropology at UNL, and he says he loves stuff and is an avid collector of several kinds of objects. And his passion for interesting objects reaches his professional life, where application of the evolutionary approach to the study of material systems is his primary research focus. In the past few years, he has investigated battlefields in Cuba as well as in western Nebraska that you'll hear about today. Our second speaker is Dr. Douglas Scott, and he's an adjunct professor of anthropology at UNL. He worked for the National Park Service for 30 years, and his last position was Great Plains team leader with the Midwest Archaeological Center here in Lincoln. He was awarded the Department of Interior's Distinguished Service Award in 2002 for his innovative research in battlefield archaeology that started with his work at the Little Bighorn National Monument. Peter and Doug?
We decided just a minute ago. We did prepare. We don't want to lose our sort of relaxed approach. But we decided just a couple of minutes ago that I'd start out by saying how we got to do this, and I guess it's worthwhile taking a point to say that the research, the activity we're talking about, is really a tag team. It's really a group effort, and it's collaborative in several respects. I've enjoyed working with Doug for a number of years on a number of projects, but he retired and sort of has found more time to hang around and be around and excite the anthropology department, so he and I have been working on it. We've also worked with, the research we're actually doing has been done with the UNL Archaeological Field School. This was the field school from the research we're talking about has gone over the past two summers. These were the kids who were out there. But the collaborative research has involved a number of people here at UNL, but we've also tried to look at and use a variety of resources. We've worked closely with the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities and been found a real exciting, sort of stimulating context for lots of ideas to steal there and techniques and insights. But we've also got an opportunity to work with kids. Basic takeaway point is archaeology is never done by individuals. It's always involved. It always involves multiple. It always involves teams. This is the team that was out last summer. This is the team that was done. That was out in 2008. This is at Camp Alexis where we did some research, and we won't be talking about that. But Doug was on that team too, but we didn't have a cameraman, so that's why he's there. The collaborative work is really an important theme. The larger point is we're going to be talking about two battlefields and the archaeology and the insights that can be obtained from them. So I'll turn it over to Doug now.
One of the important themes that we want to talk about here is not just the collaborative research, but the sources of our information, which are not only from historic documents in this case, but from Native American oral history, which has been incredibly important for us to look at. And in the early 1900s, George Hyde, a researcher, sent a drawn map showing state boundaries and rivers out to various folks, including George Bent, who participated in both of these Mud Springs and Rush Creek battles. Bent was the son of Charles Bent of Bent's Old Fort Trading Post in Colorado, a prominent fur trader in the early part of the 19th century, and George had joined the Confederate, Missouri State Guard actually, in the Civil War and fought a couple of battles and decided it as an artilleryman and decided it wasn't any fun and came back west and joined his Cheyenne Mother's Band, and after Sand Creek, which he was also at, he became a little disaffected with the white way of doing things and actually became a Cheyenne Dog Soldier and participated in a number of fights on the plains for years, and later became an interpreter. And there's a couple of fine books written on him, as a matter of fact. What we are looking at is Bent's map of where they were in the Connor expedition in Wyoming and Montana, as well as Nebraska, and the Jules Creek or Julesburg in Colorado fight after Sand Creek when the Cheyenne burned the town and looted the area, other fights along here, and then Mud Springs and Rush Creek as well. And then we get up into this area where they were getting very serious with at Mud Springs and Rush Creek up in there. So that we're dealing with a very complex scenario of what happened. And it doesn't start with Sand Creek in November of 1864, because there are other issues that had started long before that. But the animosity boils over after the Sand Creek Massacre of November of 1864, and the Cheyenne and Arapaho and Lakota are become very vengeful towards settlers, ranchers, and the army that's in the West, who are out there mainly as Union cavalrymen, not exclusively, who joined to fight the Confederacy and are sent west to guard the Overland Trail and the telegraph lines. And so they're, and the groups that we'll be dealing with are the 11th Ohio Volunteer Cavalry and 7th Iowa Volunteer Cavalries. But the two sites that we're talking about, essentially, so here's the North Platte, not far from Broadwater and Lisco, Nebraska. Everybody knows where those are, of course. This is the Mud Springs site, which actually a piece of it belongs to State Historical Society, the actual site of the Mud Springs Telegraph Pony Express Station, and the fight took place down in here. The warriors and their families were camped somewhere in this vicinity, a few miles away, and when they decided to attack Mud Springs, and there were about 9 soldiers and 5 cowboys, plus stock, at the station, and they, the Cheyenne, and including George Bent, who reports it, said they camped over here at a spring, and then they would ride over upwards of 200 warriors at a time, and perhaps more, and then they would attack the and try to capture the, in particular, the stock and destroy the station. And they did cut the telegraph wire, but on February 4th, but just a little after the soldiers already sent the message out saying help. And that was to Fort Mitchell and Fort Laramie, where their base of operations was. They were rescued, the soldiers, and nobody was killed, by the way, at least among the cowboys and soldiers at the station. There were a couple soldiers killed later on, or in the Mud Springs fight. Several wounded, maybe up to 10. Following that, the Army command of about 150 men or so followed the Lakota and Cheyenne Trail over to the springs, and the campsite found it abandoned. And then, this is on the 8th of February, and then they went down to Rush Creek, going back to the Overland Trail here, to see, and following the trail of the Lakota and Cheyenne camp. About the time they got in this area, they realized, and the North Platte's iced over, they can see the Indians crossing the river on the ice with stock and going up into this area, and they're called the White Bluffs. And they stopped, realized that the Indians were swarming back, and perhaps as many as 2,000 warriors kept these guys at bay for about a day and a half. And 2 killed there, 2 soldiers. The Lakota and Cheyenne accounts, particularly from Bent, say only a couple of Indians were wounded, none killed. So we have 4 or 5 days of fighting going on, very few casualties. And we'll get into talking about that just a little bit. There's George Bent and his wife Magpie, is our primary account from the Native American side. This is William O. Collins and the 11th Ohio Volunteer Cavalry flag. William O. Collins commanded the 11th Ohio, resigned shortly after this event. His old 1st Battalion had joined up in 62, and this was already by 65 in February. They're ready to go home. They were just about to send one battalion home and be mustered out as veterans. William O. Collins was a lawyer, of course, and went on to in politics in Ohio. His son may be better known to you. It's Casper, Wyoming. Casper Collins, who was killed by some of these same warriors, possibly a few months later. Peter, it's your turn.
All right, well, I'll give him a rest and we'll talk a little bit more. Doug's given you the overview. We've got two well-known fights, a group of Native Americans moving north, encountering a group of well-organized U.S. cavalry, and fairly well documented, as Doug says. We know we've got good accounts from both sides. But archaeology and conflict archaeology is a field that tries to expand the record, and it does that in a couple of ways. The key way that conflict archaeology expands the record is through systematic recovery of material evidence of the fight and systematic interpretation of that. Doug is a leader in that field. He has perfected and refined techniques for finding for recording evidences of battle and for interpreting that. He'll talk about it. But as anthropologists, we're also interested in trying to understand the contexts of those fights. Most of what the archaeological record indicates is boots on the ground, real tactical kinds of behavior, the behavior of warriors, of soldiers involved in combat, bullets, casings, other kinds of materials. But anthropologists understand that those kinds of activities happen in cultural milieu. We don't have very many of, we have not studied as anthropological archaeologists the higher level, the context, and we don't know very many ways of understanding the broader context. So what we've done for this project is what archaeologists always do when they need ideas, steal them. Go out and use them. It turns out that the U.S. military has developed, for obvious reasons, well, maybe they're not obvious, but the U.S. military has developed highly refined ideas, conceptual frameworks for thinking about how to plan, carry out, and execute military activities. They do that with a model that talks about strategy, that is the ideas of using power and to achieve objectives. Then they recognize an operational level, which is where those strategic policies are carried out. How do you take an idea and make it work? Those activities are described as the operations or the operational level, and tactics refer to the employment of force in combat. The military uses this model in two ways. They use it to plan plan military activities. They also use it as a context for training young officers. And archaeologists can use this model, we think, not because it describes the behavior of any unit other than the modern American military, but that it's a generic model within which we can conceptualize and describe and maybe interpret the archaeological or the behavior that was behind what we observe in the archaeological record. So what we've done is applied that model to the behavior of the Native American warriors. And again, as Doug said, this is largely a force of Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Lakota warriors. But they too had strategies, operations, and tactics involved in there. They're at the strategic level, and I could go through this fairly quickly. Please don't let me. I've got to push ahead. But the strategy of Lakota and Cheyenne war was maintain community security. Native folks saw the great expanse of the frontier and of the Great Plains as secure. As long as they could move freely, they could use mobility to maintain their security. Security was being able to move away from trouble. It was not building the kind of force that we might think of as a secure, a strong fortress that we might think of. The theater strategy at this point was to get out of Dodge. They were moving consciously away from, as Doug says, they were moving away from Sand Creek and from the complexities, the threats there. They were heading north into the Sand Hills. There was at the strategic level in Indian communities also a military tradition. To be an important person, to be an important man, was to be a warrior. So that being a warrior was how you demonstrated and also earned status in the society, in society. You demonstrated this by valorous display. In a little while, Doug will tell you about the Bo Peep fighting that took place at Mud Springs. But what would happen is, while they were at Mud Springs, guys would get up close and pop up and shoot a couple, and then, now, as Doug said, there weren't a lot of casualties, but there was a lot of valorous display. The other thing you could do, but to prove that you were a warrior, is to capture material. So the trophies and material was an important part of the military strategy. Everybody who was fighting at Mud Springs, and not everybody, the sides who were fighting at Mud Springs and at Rush Creek had very, very similar armaments, because the looting, and we call it looting, that's probably not fair, but the recovery of the capture of material was an important activity that had happened at Julesburg. Moving ahead real quickly, at an operational level, the Cheyenne were very highly, where they were adept at rapid movement. The communities could move, pick up, move, set down, spend a couple of days comfortably in an area, and then move north. The move north from the Rush Creek camp to the north side of the North Platte Valley, which led up to the second battle, is an example of that. A major operational activity for the Cheyenne were the so-called warriors or men's society. To be a member of a society was to be a man in this society essentially required being a part of a men's club. And these men's club were friends, they were trusted associates, they were evaluative colleagues, and they also knew how to hang out to one another so that they could organize group actions and a small unit actions. And they could operate from one another, so that there were groups that knew when we go into battle, we're always on your left. We are your left side. And you didn't need to know where the other side was going to be, because they were always there. They were your friends. They could organize. They also had display, so that you know from the kind of emblematic materials that made it easy to know where your pals were. At the tactical level, the Native folks, the Plains Native folks, at this time, and we're talking here at about a real specific time, 1865, and it had changed very quickly after this. They were quite capable of major sieges. That the event at Rush Creek can be described as a time when there was a fight. There was something like a siege. It was only kind of a long day and a half, but it was a real siege. There were also raids when groups of people could kind of come down and could take little forays fairly quickly focused, such as what has happened at Mud Springs. Remember, that's the fight that opened this. But there was also important individual action. This probably is not the behavior that would be approved by the ROTC here, but at certain times, it made perfectly good sense for all the bets off and for individuals to enter the fight and fight as individuals. At one point in Mud Springs, the Cowboys decided the heat was getting a little hard, and they decided to just let the stock go. Just put they want the horses, let the horses go. And the folks who were attacking them immediately broke off the fight and just ran after trying to capture and to claim the honor of touching the stock that had been released. That appears to have been a largely individual activity. The 1865, the Civil War Frontier Army also had can be thought of in terms of some levels of war. Their cause, strategically, they were there to support the real action. And this was being sent to the Aleutians, you know. This was, I mean, these guys had to wonder, how did it come to this? They had joined to fight the Confederacy and save the Union, and here they are out here. So one of the things that happened at Mud Springs is they talked, there was a secesh there. There was a guy, there was a Confederate flag that was there. We think, and many people think, that George Bent was there and that they did not know how to read him simply as a Native American. And so they were suspicious, and there was continual suggestion that Confederate agents were out there stirring the Indians up. No evidence of it, but that was there. Their other activity, their other goal, their strategy was to prevent predation. They actively maintained treaty negotiations with Indians and Indian communities through this. Generally, they had to be extensive, so it was largely there was a strategic decision to make this a cavalry action. They maintained a series of units that the modern military would see as home stations, and then also force projection bases. This was an operational way of getting small units where you needed them. The guys who were at Mud Springs would be a force projection base. There were 9 troopers, is it 9? It was a small unit. And again, they were way far away from anything that they could think of as the Civil War. They also used detached service, so that what they were good at is saddling up, getting on their horses, and riding to where the action was. Their horses were grain-fed, corralled animals, so that they were healthy, they were hardy, they were very, very mobile, and they could leave on short notice when action was needed. When they got to a particular place, they tended to fight as foot cavalry. They did not do, when they got into action, their default setting was, here's action, get off the horse, form a circle, and fight not as horsemen, but as infantry soldiers. There were some implications to that. That was their strategy. That happened a number of times in this campaign. They could do cavalry charge, but they were very rare. They were very rare. We happen to have had one. There was one at Rush Creek. They had no artillery units, but there were cannons, primarily highly mobile little mountain howitzers that were managed by cavalry units. They tended to fight from fixed positions, so that if they got to someplace, they would try and create a position. Let me take a minute and share some photographs that Bob Diffendahl and some photographs and insights that I have pleased to be able to have because of Bob. This is the North Platte Valley. Most people see this as a fairly normal part of Nebraska and the western Nebraska. It's a real distinctive area. There is Rush Creek right there. So that the town of Broadwater is kind of behind this bluff. Courthouse Rock is also right there. You can't quite see it. That's not flat country. And it's a fairly complex environment. The major part of this, and here I'm using your categorization of the landscape spot, is the river. The river is a big part of the valley. It's now got all these trees here, but as immediately associated with the river is fairly flat valley bottom. That's where the Great Platte River Road or roads were located. That's flat country. That's the area where Euro-Americans occupied this area now. That was flat. It was an easy transit area. Farther away, towards the bluff, here's the bluff on the north side. You can see the bluffs on the south side. The valley bottom gets kind of rolling. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, I won't enter into value judgments. The reality is you can get a center pivot on much of it. But it's really not, it's kind of rolling property, rolling territory. And so as you get closer here, it's almost rugged. Most of the, this is a fairly dry area. Modern irrigation has changed the water regimen, but there are springs along, not here, I don't think. But if we look on that far side, there are regular series of springs that come out of the base of the bluff. The bluff was a natural, appealing area to native folks. So that the interesting thing was, that's approximately where Mud Springs is, and this is approximately where Rush Creek is. And of course, nobody spent serious time up there on the plains. This was a night you went up to the plains for some reason, or to get to the valley here. There are different approaches, and this introduces the field work we did at the Rush Creek battlefield, which we found. But it makes the point. Here's the river. There is Rush Creek. The Army saw this, looked at it from Euro-American perspective. They're at Rush Creek, the mouth of Rush Creek. When George Bent said that where they were fighting, he said they were fighting at the White Bluffs. So that the Native American perspective focused on the bluffs. And that was one of a number of disjunctures between the two perspectives.
And I'm gonna talk about the actual archaeology of this. I want to point out, first of all, we were lucky for a couple of reasons in locating these sites. Mud Springs have been well known. Rush Creek, which is not really on Rush Creek today, it used to be Rush Creek, but it isn't now. Isn't called that. They're both preserved. One partly because of the State Historical Society and the interest in the Pony Express and that story at Mud Springs, but the other because there aren't center pivot irrigation there. It isn't conducive to that, thank heavens. Otherwise, the sites would probably be gone. So we're dealing with that. We're dealing with it. Again, I'm going to talk to you about the stuff we found, but I'm also going to try to put this in a holistic perspective. And remember, we're dealing with historic documents, Native American oral traditions and oral history, and the archaeological record. All of those have their pluses and minuses, but when you put them together, you get a complete story of the past. And I like to say that in archaeology, whereas history, historical documents, and Native American testimony or any sort of oral histories, you can get opinions intentionally or unintentionally put in there. The archaeological record doesn't have an opinion. How we interpret it might, but it doesn't have an opinion. It's there, or only factored by its preservation or lack thereof. We have some wonderful quotes about the events that took place there from both sides. Here's George Bent talking about the Mud Springs event, saying soldiers were running out of ammunition, so they turned their stock loose, the story Peter mentioned. And after this, we know the village was about 10 miles from Mud Springs. That's where we had to fight. And no Indians are killed, and I don't know how many whites were killed. He says it pretty straightforward. And Hyde had asked him, George Hyde had asked him about firearms and what weapons they had, and he says, all we ever had were Spencer carbines, that they had best guns you could get at the time. And some of those were captured, some were probably purchased in various ways. But Spencers were relatively new on the frontier at that particular point, mainly in military hands, so most of them were captured. Here's the Mud Springs site as it was drawn by Caspar Collins in 1864. A couple of buildings, they were made out of wood. Some people say they were adobe, they were not, they were wood. And the part of the Reagan Road that runs by it, it really doesn't tell you a whole lot except how the two buildings were roughly arranged. And those were the buildings occupied by the 14 people when they got their telegraph message off on the evening of the 4th of February before the lines were cut. There's the station site here in this grove of trees, which is part of the State Historical Society property. The rest of this is private property, which we were allowed to work on a few years ago. And the South Hill, which it will come into importance, and there's a pit on top, which we've designated the rifle pit, and you'll understand what we're talking about in just a second. But basically, the way this battle plays out is the cowboys and soldiers are here. The warriors come in from over here and come in around and in this wash. And remember, it's February. And get up on top of this hill and in this area and possibly elsewhere, but in particular there, and are able to place an intense amount of gunfire and arrow fire against that station. Again, no casualties, no significant casualties there until the arrival of the rescue party, and then only a couple of guys wounded, and maybe 10 wounded and a couple killed. So this is interesting. And we looked at it, and here are some of the archaeological record we found. Surprise, we have bullets. And they range from muzzle-loading pistols to Spencers and Ballards, a variety of other 58 caliber and 54 caliber bullets there. Some of the cartridges. Now, this was a Spencer and Ballard gunfight, more than it was muzzle-loading weapons. These were breech-loading cavalry weapons of the era. We were a little surprised to see the Ballards, but we did. That's a single-shot weapon. The Spencer, I'll show you in just a second the difference between them. And then we found other bits and pieces, like a harness rivet. That's actually a strap plate off of a 1859 Army spur, cut nails from the construction of the buildings, not unexpected. And things like that. But the majority of what we were looking at in the area that we investigated, where the fighting took place outside the State Historical Society property, was related to the firearms-related materials. Here, standing roughly, when the picture was taken, on the site of the building, this is a Pony Express and Mud Springs Station monument fenced off. And this is that hill looking to the south. The Indians, and accounts say this over and over, the Indians got on top of that hill and behind these ridge crests and used that cover effectively. As you can see, you can't see very much looking that way. They used that hill to conceal themselves, the military crest of it, to conceal themselves from the fire of the soldiers. Even when Colonel Collins arrived from Fort Laramie and another officer with a contingent from Fort Mitchell on the 5th and 6th, and they rode very hard to get there to rescue them, they just forded up at the station itself. And Collins, when he finally got there and got in charge, he finally organized a charge out of the station and up this hill and to rout the Indians. And that was effectively the end of the battle, and it was also a couple of his soldiers were killed at that particular time, one in the charge and one dying of wounds later. But up to that point, they did not have enough men, the soldiers, to overwhelm or beat back the Native Americans who were on that hill, 200 or more warriors, most armed with firearms. So this was a very uneven battle, and yet very few casualties. The rifle pit we talked about is up on that hill, and there are references to it in the historic record of digging a rifle pit. The question was, who dug the rifle pit? Was it the Native Americans to protect themselves from gunfire, or the soldiers? And we evaluated this, and it's pretty loose soil. It's difficult to pick it out, but the rifle pit did have materials in it, and it was from a stratigraphic profile, not very clear, but it probably looked something like that. The Army was doing these so-called hasty entrenchments from well before the Civil War, right on up to Spanish-American War, and later it evolved into the modern foxhole. But it was a hasty entrenchment dug to protect the body and throw up a little amount of material on top here so for a rifle rest and protect your head and shoulders. So basically, that's what was up there, pretty shallow. And we started looking at it. It looked more like a military rifle pit, although Native Americans dug them too. We've seen them in other places. So we decided to do an analysis using geographic information system to see if we could figure out what the viewshed were, what we, well, the military would today call weapons fan analysis. And at the station, or on the hill above the station, this is what you could see if you were in the rifle pit.
What you could shoot.
A Spencer carbine with a range of 600 meters, give or take a little bit, this is what you could shoot. At the station, this is what you could hit and see. And you had to be able to see it to shoot it. Now, if we take that rifle pit and relook at it from the point of view of what can you see for up to 10,000 meters out, this is the rifle pit. You have a pretty good view, particularly to the south. If you're at the station, you don't have as good a view, particularly to the south. But you can still command the area around you to the northeast and west to up to a point. East is a little iffy. So we believe that that rifle pit was probably dug by the military after the battle in order to provide a sentinel station and probably keep the guy out of the wind a little bit. Remember, it's February. It was an open winter, but it was still cold. So that's the kind of analysis we've been applying. It's, again, the same kind of thing that today's military is using in the field very often and making assessments of how to deal with a foe someplace along the way. And these are very useful models and very useful tools that we've applied to the archaeological record. We've done it a couple of other places as well. Now, Collins talks about the Indians getting under the banks. And he's probably talking about the creek. And he talks about their, which they watch for an Indian head and they'd shoot at the moment it was shown, the soldiers. But the men got quite handy at the game. And this is where he calls it the Indian playing bo peep, in other words, popping up. We would look at it a different way. The Native Americans employed the terrain to their advantage to be able to maintain their superiority and fire power against those in and around the buildings to the point that they broke them down and those guys had to release that stock in order to relieve the pressure on them. And then, of course, you get 180 or so men show up from Laramie and Mitchell in three different groups, actually, and save the day, so to speak, or at least that's how the cavalry would like to look at it. Now, we know that the folks at Mud Springs, the cavalry stays there on the 6th and 7th, whereas the warriors have broken off, have gone and gotten their families, and are moving up to the bluffs and across the bluffs and in toward the sand hills to find secure areas in which to remain the remainder of the winter. Collins, on the morning of the 8th, after a 12-pound mountain howitzer contingent arrives, with about 153 or 60 men, we're not quite sure, plus a few wagons, and we don't know what a few is, move out with this mountain howitzer, and they find the Indian trail, they go to the camp, find it abandoned, and then they're following that trail, turns out toward the bluffs, where they encounter the folks at Rush Creek. And as the scouts, military army scouts, are forward, probably come back, report they see all this activity at the frozen creek. And George Bent says, when the soldiers showed up, they started swarming back across that frozen river, and the army folks, the cavalry, 11th Ohio and 7th Iowa contingent, forded up basically. They circled the wagons almost literally. They dug into the sandy soil, protect themselves, and there was a fierce gun battle and fight and hand-to-hand combat that went on. George Bent sees it another way, as you can see from this quote. I got up on the bluffs. And he had a fine pair of field glasses his dad had given him. And he could see these companies corralled. And he was about right. It was about four understrength companies. They were corralled near the river. And so he's out there 1,000 yards away from them. And the Indians, only about 10 Indians, got within 200 yards of the soldiers. And he talks about the events there. He talks about the charge. And we'll come to that in just a second, where the Yellow Nose comes out and they they actually get out of there. And they said they killed three of them. They actually only killed two. And so there were two soldier casualties there, plus a few wounded, but not very much. And the soldiers used cannon here with grape shot. Well, the cannon they had did not fire grape shot, but it did fire canister and what was called case shot. Here's George Rowan, a private in Company D of the 7th Iowa, talking about what he saw at Rush Creek after the Army forded up and or circled the wagons, dug in, and started shooting back at these hundreds and thousands of warriors that were surrounding them. And they talking about, again, the cannon fire, and the cannon was mainly possibly fired toward the river, but certainly at this charge, and they talk about the charge again, which dislodged the Indians, and that essentially ended the battle. That's absolutely correct and consistent with what Bent was saying. George Nelson, another 11th Ohio volunteer private, and these accounts are written in the 1890s and early 1900s. They're published in the National Tribune, the Grand Army of the Republic's veterans newspaper for the Union Army. And they talk about, again, digging in the sand, throwing up a breastwork. Indians surrounded us except on the side next to the Platte, and it seemed that the whole prairie was alive with them, meaning, of course, the Indians. And true, we had a strong position, and but they outnumbered us 10 to 1, probably absolutely accurate there. Our work in the field did turn up a little bit different kind of information than we were expecting even. Basically, we recovered quite a large number of these cartridge cases, Spencers and Ballards again. There's a Ballard with a fired bullet and a Spencer unfired. We found a few unfired ones. And this is the artifact distribution we found. Remember, Rowan and Nelson are talking about being surrounded, and that the only place open was this area down by the Platte. And here's the creek. And the red dots here indicate our grid that we use for laying this out. The yellow indicate very late 19th century and 20th century farm machinery, hay rakes, other activities unrelated to the 1865 event out there. A little bit of homesteading material here. There was a homestead down here in the 1890s. And we got a trash dump up in here. The green dots indicate mainly what we believe are soldier positions and certainly cartridge cases related to that event of 1865. The blue are bullets, and the red out here, the dark red, actually indicate an artillery round burst. But as you can see, we're not finding very much stuff except for modern materials out this way. We did actually inventory clear over to here. And some of this out here, it's not clearly marked on there. Didn't want to clutter the map up too much. The way we did this was use gold positioning systems to plot the artifacts as we found them. And I've eliminated everything here but the Army and Indian-related materials to 1865. This, we believe, and these are mainly cartridge cases, fired cartridge cases, in these three clusters, and then scattered across here with a few bullets that indicate where the Army circled the wagons and dug these expedient, hasty entrenchments to protect themselves. Unfortunately, the sands out there are not conducive to preservation of those breastworks. They're probably just small trenches. In fact, if anything, those breastworks, when they dug them, may have hastened the erosion out there, and so it probably destroyed them. But you can see there's a strong position here, there's nothing in between, another strong position here, another one here, and scattered stuff there. And we think the wagons are probably in here. So consider that one quarter at least of the force was holding the wagon, or maintaining the security on the wagons and holding the horses while the other fat crowd were out fighting. Only 150 to 160 soldiers involved here. Again, several hundreds, if not 1,000 to 2,000 warriors. The cannon being fired, we have no evidence in this direction whatsoever, but we have at least one artillery case shot burst in this area, and a canister ball over here. There are undoubtedly more out there. We just didn't happen to run into them. Yes?
What's your scale here? How far apart are these?
We aren't going to tell you. The distance between here and here is about 600 meters, 600 yards, give or take a little bit, and from here to here about 400 yards. If that makes sense to you, okay. Here are some of the kinds of bullets we were finding. Pistol bullet from a Colt 36 caliber revolver. Ballard, this is a 58 caliber mini ball. Somebody had and it was in the Army position. It's unfired, it was lost. This is probably a case shot ball. It's a 69 caliber ball that may have been inside the iron sphere, 12-pound sphere that burst. That was a shrapnel round of the day. And this is the 12-pounder canister round. They're not supposed to fire iron, by the way, in those 12-pound mountain howitzers, but apparently they didn't pay attention to the rules. Here are the Ballard and Spencer. Ballard is a single-shot weapon. It fires this 44 caliber round. And the lever drops and it's loaded through the breech. It's an early cartridge gun. The 11th Ohio actually was armed with Spencer rifles, not carbines as normally carried by the cavalry. Here's a Spencer carbine. Some of them may have been out there by that time. They did get them about this time sent to Fort Laramie. But this loaded through the trap in the breech and can hold up to 7 rounds. It is the classic gun that was called that could be loaded on Sunday and shot all week. If you only needed one shot. But it is a repeating weapon, and it was a favorite of the Union Civil War Cavalry, and actually Confederacy when they could get a hold of it. Now, one of the things that we did is use the techniques we've used elsewhere on other Indian War battlefields, is microscopic analysis of these very well-preserved cartridge cases. Here you see two of them under a comparison microscope, one here, one here. You can see these firing pin imprints, which are very typical of a Ballard and a rectilinear, but you can see the differences in them, and there are two separate cartridge types or firing pin imprints there indicating two separate guns. This is a case where you've got one on top and one on the bottom. You can see they match. We can say that was fired in one gun. With that kind of information, with the plotting the way we did it very carefully, now there are 21 different firearms represented in this group of cartridge cases on that field. The different colors will match, such as this color, this color, this color, and this color, if I'm reading them right, or cartridges fired in the same weapon. There are 5 Spencers and 16 Ballards represented in this group of cartridge cases. That's 21 men, 21 guns. And that the distance here is about 60 feet by 30 feet. So we're able, and we can literally say, these cartridges are being extracted from these guns and dropped in these areas. There might be a little movement from erosion, but unlikely. At least not significant enough to change the overall pattern. But with that kind of information, we were able to figure out that we've got about 30% of the weapons represented of what would have been carried by the cavalry at the time. And with that, we can then say, these clusters are likely Army positions. So here are the Army, and the end ends out here. This is, if you remember the accounts that Bent and everybody else is saying, they talk about the charge and that the cannon was fired to break this up. The charge where the two soldiers were killed probably went in this direction. Now they talk about getting under the banks. The warriors getting under the banks and protecting themselves. That's the Army accounts. We actually expected them to be here on the creek. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. But there is an old terrace right here of the Platte River that would form a bank. And we believe it's probably a little bit eroded today, more so than it was at the time. But that terrace is probably where these guys were actually coming across the Platte here, swinging way out, coming in, and the 10 or 20 or whatever it was number of warriors who were getting out of the bank and firing into those positions. Not 2,000 warriors firing into those positions. Most of them, we think, were out way out here. And likely they were just holding. This was a kind of a holding action. Peter called it a siege. In fact, it is. This is to keep these guys pinned down while the families get away and the village gets away and the people and the families and the dependents are secure. So these warriors are just hovering around it here, pinning these guys down. There are fights. We can see no evidence whatsoever of hand-to-hand fights, consistent with George Bent's account, inconsistent with some of the soldiers' reminiscences 40 years after the fact. The artillery firing certainly did occur, and that is probably the area under this bank that they broke that up, and that's probably the area of the charge. So we have some very specific evidence that we can equate archaeologically with the oral history and oral traditions of the Cheyenne and Lakota, as well as the documentary evidence. In fact, what really holds up the best is the Native American accounts. We can interpret them more precisely in concert with the archaeological record than we can the Army accounts. Not to say they're all incorrect, but that's what we're doing in the process of writing our report. And...
Well, just to kind of wind up, we want to wind up with two kind of takeaway messages. These were two fights that happened within 20 miles of one another. And ask Doug about the matches between the bullet matches between the two battles. But they're within 15 miles of one another. They're within days of one another. But as studied with these tools, they're very, very different kinds of fights. The landscapes were different. One was in the part of the valley that the Native Americans were very comfortable with, viewed as home. The other was in the part that the Army would have seen as their countryside. There were very different strategies. The Cheyenne were raiding, engaged in a raid and a valorous display versus a defense and 3 days, 3 and 4 days later at Rush Creek. The Army was protecting a projecting face versus undertaking a force projection. This is also a different time. This is an Indian war that's very different from what happened a few years later. This was a time when conflicted coexistence made perfectly good sense. This was not the strategy. This contributed to the strategies of the Indian War period, but it was very, very different. There were also different tactics in terms of the two fights. The Cheyenne were at one hand using much more individual and small group action, and in the other fight were quite capable of acting. We're clearly acting as a very well organized group. And military unit. The Army also had a couple of different kinds of tactics that were involved here. So that the texture of these two apparently very similar fights, so close in time and space, is actually really, really different. But there's probably more that we can do too, and Doug will tell you those.
And this is just the wind up here. Very quickly, historic documents provide us one aspect of the story, just as I was saying earlier, and in summary. Our archaeological data, systematically collected, analyzed, provides us another look at it. That's another set of evidence. Testing these data against one another and against the oral historical record and the Native American accounts provides another point of view. And then laying them again over that model of these Army tenets and operational standards allows us a more detailed understanding to specific to the past at the site level. At the broader level, we're beginning to see these things at the number of battlefields that have been studied around the United States, Civil War, Indian Wars, others, as well as other sites around the world. We're beginning to get a refine a model of the anthropology of war. That's getting pretty big theoretical sorts of stuff, and we don't need to belabor that. Peter did mention, I forgot to say, when we did that cartridge case comparison, we went back and looked at the mud springs versus the cartridges and cases that were at Rush Creek, and we were able to find matches between a couple of the Spencers and one of the Ballards. So we can link those two sites. This is the first battlefield we've ever been able to do that with. First two battlefields we've ever been able to do that with.